This Do Lectures episode features founder of New Media Advocacy Project, Adam Stofsky. Adam's project has helped secure positive outcomes for the civil rights of Nigerian forced evictees, minority voters, as well as many more. Recorded live at the Global Event in California, USA in 2012.
So thanks everyone. I really appreciate this opportunity. Here we go. Let's take a moment to echo two of today's earlier speakers. John began his talk by saying, if he slips into sort of corporate speak, I forgot the words he used, then you could, you know, sort of pelt him with tomatoes. Same thing for me. When you start a social enterprise, you're kind of pitching all the time. It's like I have a button on my head, and I just push it, and I start pitching. So if I slip into pitch mode, I apologize and just kind of call out, because I definitely don't want to pitch to you. I want to explore the work that Nmap is doing. I also just want to sort of add something to the story I was going to tell. My sort of journey into this kind of work, like Maggie, started on a sort of soul-searching backpacking trip around the world. And it took me about maybe 10 or 12 years to kind of figure out what to do. Maggie kind of just did it right there. She's more courageous than I am. But it was that moment of obligation, just traveling. I was in a refugee camp in Hungary, and then I was in India, and just seeing a lot of really hard things. You just can't believe it, and you just cannot believe that we live in a world where these kinds of things can happen, poverty, human rights violations. And, you know, I think it was, I hate to say it this way, but almost refreshing to see Maggie's kind of raw emotion and tears, even now, after she's been doing this for a number of years. It's easy to get kind of cynical or just inured to all the horrors that we see in this field. And I thought that was really wonderful, and I really relate to it quite powerfully. So thank you for that. So I run an organization called the New Media Advocacy Project. As Richard mentioned, I am a lawyer, and the work we do at Nmap came directly out of my legal work. And interestingly, it wasn't like I kind of did this. There's a story. I was in the corporate world, and then I just had this revelation, and I decided to, you know, start something new. In a way, the foundational work that led to me founding Nmap started when I was way back in law school, and I'll tell you that whole story. But it took me 3 more years of law school and then about 5 years of legal practice to really feel like I had the skills to make this happen, which was kind of, and not to mention some kind of social pressure from law school to kind of do the normal path and the clerkships and the fellowships and the big law firm jobs. It's a lot to fight against in a lot of ways. So it kind of, in a way, the plan developed over a number of years, and then finally the moment hit. So what Nmap does in a nutshell, this is a little bit grandiose, I say we're transforming advocacy for the 21st century, but basically we're sort of merging media and law. We're helping human rights lawyers and advocates around the world, including the US, more effectively integrate new technology into their legal work. I often say we're trying to make sure that the benefits of the tech revolution are shared by the world's most vulnerable communities, and that they can use those tools in the places that affect their lives most: courts, legislatures, government agencies, international organizations. I think new technology has the power to truly elevate the voices of the world's most vulnerable, particularly when guided by the knowledge of lawyers and advocates. And it's quite a interesting kind of peanut butter and jelly type marriage. So instead of doing legal briefs, we work largely in voices and images, the power of place and the power of people. And you can just see some examples right here. So this work started for me, as I mentioned, in my first year of law school, my 1L year, as we say. Are there any lawyers in the crowd? Wow. Usually, like everyone, but the things I'm at, everyone raises their hand. Like any lawyers, like everyone raises their hand. So that's actually quite interesting. Well, we say 1L. That was my first year of law school. So many law students will go do something a bit more adventurous their first year before they're sort of sucked into the vortex of law firm life and the normal path. And I admit this very, very inspiring Nigerian human rights lawyer, who you'll meet later in the presentation, who did sort of a mix of community organizing and lawyering in Nigeria. And I wanted to go somewhere abroad. I wanted to do human rights. And so I asked him for a job, and he said, yeah, come to Nigeria. It'll be crazy. It'll be fun. And so I was charged when I got there. It was right after the dictatorship fell. And I was charged with working with a community called the Maroko community. And Maroko was a quite large slum, I guess you'd call it a slum, of 300,000 people that had built up right next to Lagos. The community members called it a service town for the sort of wealth that sort of concentrated in Lagos after Nigeria's oil boom. And basically, Lagos is a series of islands, so they ran out of land to, you know, give to, you know, judges and generals and loyalists to the dictatorship. So the government basically just invaded Morocco. It was almost a military invasion, and destroyed the city of 300,000 people, pretty much while people were still home. I mean, they just destroyed it. They gave them 7 days notice on the radio, and people thought they were joking, actually. But the community, the core community, stayed organized and kind of just fled a few miles away and squatted in these sort of half-built housing complexes called Ilasan, which is, you see an image of it right here. And they filed a lawsuit. And when I had gotten there, the lawsuit had been winding around the Nigerian courts for 12 years, and nothing had happened. And so my job was to go out there and be a lawyer and do a lot of interviews, a lot of statistical research, and develop a human rights report. And it would have been the third human rights report on this community. There was one by Human Rights Watch, another by another human rights organization. And I started doing it, and it was interesting, and I loved working with these people. I was in this community every day. But I kind of had my doubts that it just sort of felt like make work in a way, that this human rights report was going to really do anything. But I had brought a video camera with me, really just for fun. I'd never shot video before. Final Cut Pro had just come out, kind of dating myself in a way there. It was like 2002. It's like kind of many, many technological generations ago. But I thought it'd be cool to have a camera and just document my experience in Lagos. But instead, what I did was I interviewed my clients. Particularly this guy, Samuel Ayayemi, who's a community leader walking doggedly in his galoshes through his very, very flooded malarial community that he's been forced to live in for, you know, pretty much 20 years now. And the guy was amazing on camera, and he was really stunning on camera. I just couldn't stop interviewing him. I think I interviewed him sort of 6 hours during the course of the time there. And I kept interviewing people and taking images of the community. And before long, I shot 40 hours of footage, and my human rights report had morphed into a video. And I worked very closely with the lawyers to develop a strategy for using this video to try to push this case towards settlement. Now, I wasn't trying to make a beautiful video, and it was definitely not a beautiful video. It's funny, going back, we make a lot of beautiful videos now. It's kind of like going back and looking at your, you know, high school essays or something like that. But it worked. It took me a year to edit the thing, and I sent it back to Nigeria. And we showed it to two government officials, basically, who were the opposing counsel, and they were scared by it, and they sat down to talk for the first time in 12 years. And that, in and of itself, was a huge victory. So I thought, oh, this is cool. Wow, video can really help win a case. So I kind of kept that in mind. And then after law school, I decided to go work at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in Washington, D.C. I decided to learn to, I had this idea of doing media and law, but I wanted to learn to be a lawyer first. You know, I wanted to learn my trade, as it were. And there was a little bit of like that sort of prestige pushing that you get. I was a little bit sort of trapped in the profession, but I decided to do it. And part of my fellowship was to explore new methods for using media to win tough human rights and civil rights cases. And it wasn't really any more defined than that. So I went to work at the Lawyers Committee, which does all kinds of civil rights work. And I'll just tell you, there were a bunch of victories there where we use media in a variety of ways. But I'll tell you one quick story. It's a litigation, so this is the most lawyerly stuff you can have. We were suing, I can't talk about the case in any detail, that's why I'm calling it a vague case about some bad things. This is a problem as a litigator, is you have all these great stories I want to tell, but we often have these confidentiality problems, so I can't talk about it. So I'll do it as best I can. Quick version is, there was a factory, this is in the American South in the US in the early 2000s, and basically there was a segregated bathroom in this workplace, and there was a whites-only sign on the bathroom door, and our clients were 13 African-American men who had to, you know, walk 300 meters into a different building to use the bathroom. I mean, it was completely shocking. So of course, we were really excited, right, as civil rights lawyers, because we can actually win this case. It's kind of perverse. You get really excited about the horrors that you see. And we had great clients. Anyway, the case was going really well for us. We took about 8 depositions, and they took about 8 depositions of our clients. A deposition is a formal interview with the other side's witnesses where you get information about the case, and it's sworn testimony. So we got into mediation to try to settle the case. Otherwise, we're looking at years of horrible litigation and trial. And the mediator looked at us and said, you know what, I get that these facts are bad, but I just don't see it. I think you should take the 10 grand they're offering you and go home. And we were completely shocked. We couldn't believe it, because there is like literally no way to get a better case than this. So what I did was I took the videos of the depositions, these horrible, you know, green, badly recorded videos, and I essentially created my perfect trial out of these videos, like thinking as a lawyer. We showed it to the mediator. He was completely shocked by how strong our witnesses were and how bad the other guys were. And a week later, we settled for over $1 million. And the video clearly wasn't the only thing that, I mean, there's obviously some great lawyering that really did the job, but the video clearly, clearly tipped the balance. And nothing that was in that video was not in the little document we gave the mediator, but there was something about seeing it that made a huge difference. And that was kind of the key moment that made me realize, all right, this needs to be done more. I'm gonna get a job at one of the many organizations that's clearly doing this. And I looked around, I really couldn't find anyone. So I decided to start it myself, which was, you know, a little bit crazy. But here we are 3 years later, and things are going really well. We're very successful. We've got clients all over the world. There seems to be a kind of hunger for this sort of merging of media and law. So what we do is we basically use video and increasingly other technologies, social media, mapping, interactive media. We're even exploring games now. We use those tools to try to find new and creative ways to win really tough human rights cases. It's like 80 or 90% video still. A lot of everything from some evidence videos in court to the kinds of things I described to you, pressuring opponents to settle, looking for every little nook and cranny in the system where we can get our clients' voices in the door. And fundamentally, our work is about elevating the voices of our clients. That's, I think at heart, what motivated me to do this initially was my respect for guys like Ayayemi, the man with the galoshes I mentioned. I kind of realized, wow, these guys are really wise, far more wise than I am. And their voices are far more articulate than I am about their, you know, the injustices they faced. I know the rules of evidence and I know how to file a lawsuit, but ultimately the really persuasive voice is gonna be his. So I thought, well, why not find a way to do this, in a way kind of humble myself. I mean, lawyers are often taught, the legal system becomes about lawyers fighting with each other rather than clients telling their stories. And I sort of had an insight, well, why don't we try to turn this around a little bit? And so as a lawyer, I really got frustrated with various obstacles to justice. And I think this idea of clients being silenced is kind of encapsulated in the first one here. It's just really hard to tell a story of injustice in the legal system, particularly in litigation. You know, you file a lawsuit and you get in there and you know, suddenly you have an opposing lawyer who's objecting to what you say all the time. By the time you tell your story, it's whittled down to this kind of legalese, and it's deeply unsatisfying. There are very good reasons for this, right? I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing in and of itself. We need to have rules of evidence. We don't want juries making decisions based on who tells the most emotional story. So there's a bit of an interesting paradox in this, because I do think that's a good thing. But as an advocate who represents very vulnerable people and communities who have been the victims of human rights violations, I really feel that there's got to be better ways to let our clients tell those stories, in part because that in and of itself it can be a sort of healing act for them. A lot of legal claims are really difficult to prove. A lot of horrible injustices happen and you just can't win. It happens all the time. I mean, take poverty, for example. Poverty in and of itself is a horrible thing. It's deeply unjust. It's often caused by sort of systems and people. But it's not illegal, at least not in the U.S. The elements of poverty are illegal elsewhere, but not in the U.S. Some courts are very backlogged. It can take, you know, many, many years to win a case. So someone, I'll mention later, a project we're working on evictions in the Caucasus. And people are waiting 10 years to get a judgment, and they're essentially homeless. So, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. And of course, there's a huge resource gap often between our clients and the people that they're fighting against, often government agencies, big corporations, and they often have nothing. And finally, a lot of judgments don't get enforced. What this means is you can actually win a case. You win this huge victory after years of grueling fighting and litigation or fighting in the legislature, and then nothing happens because you can't motivate the government to actually enforce the judgment. And this is, in many ways, the most frustrating thing. We're doing a lot on this because, in a way, when you're fighting for a judgment to get enforced, you're not in court anymore. We're kind of out in the public, out in the open, and we can be free to make all kinds of great videos. So anyway, what NMAP does is we incinerate the obstacles to justice. I want to see that again. It's a taking advantage of Keynote. This is great. So that's what we do. We try to use media to elevate our clients' voices directly to overcome those obstacles. So I'm going to give you some examples of some cases we're working on. The problem is that they often are a bit hard to explain because they tend to get kind of bound up in the legal technicality. So I'll try to be efficient. And if you have any questions about these, you know, I'm open to talk more at any time. This is an interesting case. It's the Haiti Cholera Campaign. Our clients are it's the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and they're representing 5,000 Haitians who are the victims of basically the UN's inadvertent spreading of cholera into Haiti. They essentially, a bunch of peacekeepers didn't clean their sewage and dumped cholera into the water supply and infected many, many Haitians. But the UN has complete immunity in Haitian courts. So what we had to do was essentially build a media campaign to pressure people to get the UN to pay damages and give a remedy to these Haitian victims. And it was interesting because a lot of the people who care about Haitian human rights also really like the United Nations. So we had to kind of walk a pretty fine line there. The Makakon water case, this is a power of place has actually played into this really well. You can see this kind of stunning spot here. It's a neighborhood in Lagos, Nigeria, that exists entirely on water. It's actually an ancient village that sort of existed on water, and the entire city kind of built up around it. And it's actually amazing. You walk through this community, and you can't tell where the water really begins. So suddenly, boats are everywhere, and it's quite a magical place. But it's under threat pretty much at all times. The government wants to destroy it to sort of build fancy real estate on the coast. So we made two videos for two different audiences. One was for the general Lagos public to educate them on what this kind of weird place was in their community, to try to build a constituency to preserve it. And the other was based on some interviews we did with government officials, where it turns out they weren't evil villains wanting to destroy people. They actually really wanted to improve their city. And they kept comparing it to like Paris and London. And they'd say, one day Lagos is going to be just like Paris. And we really want it to be just like Paris. So we made this video, almost like a joke, kind of comparing Makoko to Venice, which then got it in front of all these legislators. And the argument was, look, this could be, a real treasure and frankly an economic engine for Nigeria. Don't destroy it. I mean, what if Venice had been destroyed 300 years ago? That would have been a pretty dumb idea from any standpoint. So that's kind of unconventional legal advocacy, but it's the kind of thing that can really make people think a bit differently. I'm actually going to sort of skip through these because we're low on time. I'll just talk about them quickly. We made an evidence video for a litigation surrounding the Haitian earthquake and accountability for NGOs to actually give aid to the camps. This is Armenia evictions case. We made a video to pressure the European Court of Human Rights to stop taking 7 to 10 years to decide cases. Using the stories of evictee families like this. This is a case in the U.S. We're trying to fight against overly harsh school discipline rules that kind of came into effect after Columbine. It's called the school-to-prison pipeline, where students are essentially being criminalized for kind of normal, stupid kid behavior, like, writing stuff on, Wow. That's cool. for like talking back to a teacher and stuff like that, they're actually getting handcuffed and pulled out of school and put into the court system. So we use the voices of youth who are victims of this, like this woman, Tiffany, use their voices to build a legislative campaign to fight against this. So sorry for racing through those. I want to get to the sort of important point while we're not running out of time. What all of this is based on is what I call a client-centered advocacy. The idea is that the lawyer is not at the center of the work. It's really our clients and their incredible stories and their incredible personas. And this idea of client-centered advocacy kind of came to me early on in my legal career. This is in Lagos, Nigeria, that summer I told you about when I was discovering all this stuff. And the community leaders who I kind of at that point almost worshipped, it was a real reverent feeling towards them, they made me sign a contract that I would actually go and follow through on what I had told them I was going to do, which was make this movie. And they said, look, Adam, you've been here all summer. You've gotten this great experience. You're going to put it on your resume. They actually told me this. He was like, you're going to, this is, we've done so much good stuff for you. And you know what? You've done nothing for us yet. You think you have. You've been working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day, running around to all these villages, exposing yourself even to some danger, whatever. I don't care. No results yet. You know? You've done nothing. All these Americans come through and they think they're so good and they go home and they show their cool pictures to their friends. We want you to promise that you're not going to be one of those people, that you're actually going to do this. And so they made me sign this, they bought me this kind of ridiculous outfit and put it on me as a celebratory thing. And then they made me, so I don't have a picture of all of us, but that's me signing. And then that's sort of my clients all signing it. And that was a pretty powerful moment. It really made me realize that truly this is not about me. This is fundamentally about them. And so what client-centered advocacy really means is that we're gonna use the power of our clients and their voices to win tough cases. So let's go through a few kind of random points about client-centered advocacy. It's all based on trust in clients. You know, a lot of our clients are completely uneducated, very, very different culturally. They're just very, very different, and it's easy to sort of take the elitist view and think, I'm the lawyer, I know how to do this. I think a fundamental trust in our clients that they kind of know what they're talking about. They know the facts of their case, and they even have a kind of keen sense of tactics. That's key. I think trust in myself is also really important. I think there's often a bit of hand-wringing, perhaps. Maybe that's too strong, but maybe too much questioning about sort of cultural differences and fears of sort of power differentials. That's all important to think about, but at the end of the day, I think you just need to go out and do the work and do your best and sort of have some faith and shared humanity to do the job well. I'm sure there are many, many people who disagree with me on that, but that's sort of been my view, and I think it's served me pretty well so far. Mistakes will be made, make them a lot. I think this is actually true of any kind of social enterprise situation at all. Actually, everyone's talked about it so far. I think it can't be overemphasized. I think that the flaw with our education system is that we make people so afraid to make mistakes. That's like the worst thing you can do, right? Is make mistakes. But actually, like, in starting this thing, I feel like I make them all the time. But you sort of stop thinking about it. I mean, I'm sure you made tons of mistakes, getting blue bottles. So maybe, I don't know, maybe you're some kind of business genius, but it's just like this constant stream of mistakes. But that's sort of how that's how you do something challenging. Faces can say more than words. I'm going to lead into that in a second. The law is very verbal. It's all about words and writing legal briefs. And we're trying to bring more faces into the situation, which have proven very powerful, actually, in interesting ways. And finally, the bottom line is that people really do have power. And I think we've seen that in the talk so far, particularly Maggie's, is that people do have power. Our job as lawyers really is just to find ways to, in almost a minimalist way, to unleash that power. And that's what we're trying to do. And I think media can let that happen, if only because we can sort of record people's voices. So I'm going to close with just some portraits from our videos that I think really illustrate the power of people, and then a statement from my mentor in Nigeria on video. So enjoy these. So these are all just basically grabbed frames from our videos. All portraits used in various contexts. So I'm going to close with this, because this very wonderful Nigerian human rights lawyer can say this far, far better than I can about sort of people power in the law. I say putting the human back in human rights. but anyway, here we go.
Now, often when the government fails in its responsibility to uphold human rights, like I said, there are consequences. And one of the I think realities or assumed realities that drives the government is the idea that people are helpless, that people are powerless, that people don't know their rights, that they don't know the law, and that if and when they actually know the law and know their rights, the government assumes that they have no capacity to, in fact, enforce or implement those rights or to, you know, discipline government. Now, generally speaking, that is what drives, you know, often, you know, massive human rights violations, because government thinks they can get away with it. Now, CERAC's role, essentially, is to change that, is to demonstrate that there isn't really anything that people, when they're organized, when they come together in their numbers, cannot achieve. To demonstrate that there's, you know, latent power in people, and that people have power in their hands, and that when that power is unleashed in a way that is, you know, cultivated with information, with knowledge, that it can actually, you know, resist and displace, you know, the sort of violations that created, say, as I said, a lesson, you know, Maracol reality.
So thank you all. You can find every video that I've mentioned and many, many more on our website, so take a look. And if you want to see anything, I can just show you directly. So thanks so much.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people and the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or, if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out. For our weekly curation of wonder and optimism, sign up to our newsletter by visiting thedolectures.com/newsletter.